Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor.
We sit here in the studios of lovely KALW in San Francisco, our presenting station. We're just talking philosophy, drinking coffee, getting wired, just as we do at Philosophy Corner at Stanford.
You can join us on the radio live. You can go to our website online at www.kalw.org. That's not ours. That's KLW's website. And if you want to join our discussion and submit an online comment, go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. So, John, what's our topic this week?
Our topic this week, Ken, is markets and morality.
Yeah. What's so philosophical about that? I mean, markets are really cool. I mean, if you got enough money, you can get whatever you want. There's somebody who will make what you want and sell it to you at a price you can afford. So, you know, markets can make everybody happy. Sounds like good things.
Well, Ken, I know you went to the University of Chicago, but I'm a little surprised. I mean, so like you need a kidney, you're a philosophy professor, and you don't get it. And instead it goes to the ad rep for General Motors that's got a lot more money. Is that fair? Is that the way we want to distribute things? Are markets always the right way to do it?
Yeah, you got me there. I mean, that does make me a little squeamish. You know, it seems to me like a kidney should go to the person who most needs it, not the person who can best afford it or something like that. You got me a little squeamish, but okay. No organ sales. But what other reasons would there be to restrict the market? That seems like, you know, a small exception.
Well, how about prostitution? You think that people ought to be able to sell sexual favors to the highest bidder and that ugly people like us would just be shut out?
Ugly people with a lot of money wouldn't be. I know people think that prostitution is somehow morally wrong or problematic and there shouldn't be markets in sex, sexual favors. I don't really see the argument for that myself. I mean, if it's a bargain, you know, if a woman or a man wants to charge a party for sexual favors and that person's willing to pay for the sexual favors, I don't see any great wrong with that. That's not like organs. That's different from organs.
It's not like organs, I guess. But, I mean, I think the argument is that it's kind of debasing. You have something that was meant to be a gift, freely given. And if you sell it, you're just converting it into a commodity.
Yeah, well, I don't quite see what's wrong with that. You know, I don't want to sound like an utter Marship worshiper, though, because, you know, I think there are some things I'm not quite sure that there are things we shouldn't sell on the market, but I do think there are things that the market doesn't do a good job of distributing.
So,
like healthcare for elderly people.
Healthcare for elderly.
You know, houses for poor people.
Houses for poor people. So basically, you're in favor of government-controlled markets and everything except sex.
Yeah, well, you might put it that way, you know. But you want to hear somebody who's really, you want to know somebody who's really, really in favor of markets. That's the Ayn Rand.
Yeah. I'm sorry to tell you this, Ken. She's dead. We won't be able to hear from Ayn Rand.
Yeah, but we have a representative of the Ayn Rand Institute in Amy Standen's report this week, our roving philosophical reporter, you know, who sets our abstract stuff in concrete context every week. This week, Amy files the following report.
First, the facts. According to the U.S. 2000 census, 12% of Americans live in poverty. For a family of four, that means living on a combined annual income of about $19,000. So let's talk about markets and morality. If this is life under capitalism, why are so many Americans poor?
We all know what the steps you should take are to raise your productivity and increase your wealth.
This is Harry Binswanger, a scholar of objectivism, the philosophy outlined by the Russian-born writer Ayn Rand.
You should get some education. You should do the best damn job you can and get promoted. You should save money, invest the money wisely. That's what capitalism makes possible. It can't happen under other systems.
You'd be hard-pressed to find more enthusiastic boosters of capitalism than the folks at the Ayn Rand Defense of Capitalism Project. In Binswanger's view, for instance, if free market capitalism isn't working, that's because it's simply not free enough.
People ask me this, under laissez-faire capitalism, what would happen to the poor? And my answer is they would get rich along with everyone else. Freedom is not only necessary for the soul, it's necessary for the body. It enables you to get rich. That's the American dream and that's the American reality. So everybody gets rich when the men of ability are left free to produce. Capitalism is simply the system in which everyone is totally 100% free to act on his own judgment. as long as he respects the equal freedom of others to act on their judgment. That's all the capitalism is.
If capitalism is the system in which we're all the most free, then according to Binswanger, the government should do nothing. No taxes, no environmental laws, no regulation that would interfere with capitalism and with our ability to make money.
Bill Gates, Martha Stewart, Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, what are the conditions that these people require in order to spectacularly benefit all of us and themselves? All they need is to be left alone.
But what about those 34 million Americans in poverty? Do we, as individuals, have an obligation to help them?
None whatever. Nor do they have any obligation to help you. What would be the source of that obligation? To say that you have an obligation to the community would mean that some people have a right to a free ride at your expense. We're either all living for ourselves or some people are living for other people. We can't all live for other people. That's the contradiction in the altruist morality, the morality of self-sacrifice.
Greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works.
Sound familiar? This is Michael Douglas as Gordon Gekko from the movie Wall Street.
Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Thank you very much.
Ayn Rand would probably have agreed with him. She believed that government should be a reflection of human nature. And if humans are innately selfish, well, then government should do nothing that would get in the way of that selfishness. So what about the free market? Do we let it run wild with selfish abandon? Or make laws that save us from our own greedy selves? For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Thanks, Amy. Ken, Ayn Rand had pretty clear views, and we've heard them very nicely expressed. I must say, I think there's a little philosophical problem at the bottom of them. I mean, we're all motivated by our own desires and not someone else's, but lots of us have desires that aren't aimed at our own selves. There's a difference between the possessor of the desire and the object of the desire. And it seems to me as much human nature to care about your kids and the people you see and to have what Hume called sympathy as to always have selfish desires.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, that's a point that Bishop Butler made a long time ago. And I think you're probably right. Let's get another voice in here, though, John. We've invited Liz Anderson to be our guest. Liz Anderson is a professor of philosophy, women's studies, and law from the University of Michigan. She's the author of a widely read book, a really excellent book, Value in Ethics and Economics. She joins us from the studios of WUOM in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Liz, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Hi, Liz. John Perry here. You don't have to read too carefully between the lines of your book to realize that you're not totally in agreement with Ayn Rand about the value of markets. Why don't you sketch your view about markets and when they're appropriate and when they aren't?
Well, maybe a good starting point would be to think about the comments about greed as being good. I'm perfectly happy to accept that greed or self-interest is a useful motivation that can be harnessed for good purposes. The issue here is about harnessing greed. Greed can sometimes run out of control and very much to the detriment of people. And the way to harness it or channel it in productive directions is to impose certain kinds of regulations on its expression. So, for instance, to take a classic example, we can look at regulations of the labor market. Today, workers enjoy many protections of their autonomy and dignity due to things like minimum wage laws and anti-discrimination laws. And they don't contravene self-interest, but they do channel and direct it in ways that prevent people from being exploited and demeaned.
Some people would argue, I guess the lovers of the market would argue that those kind of regulations, you know, they distort the market. And in the end, I mean, this is kind of the Milton Friedman line, I guess. In the end, they make everybody worse off.
Do more harm than good.
They do more harm than good. What do you think about that argument?
I don't think the empirical evidence for that view is very strong. If you look at minimum wages, for instance, I'm perfectly happy to agree that you can't impose a minimum wage of $20 an hour and expect good consequences. But minimum wages that nudge up the market wage a little bit higher and apply pressure on firms are probably a good idea. Yeah. Even if in the short run they lead to a little bit increased unemployment, in the long run they inspire employers to invest in equipment that will make their low-wage workers more productive.
Well, it was Henry Ford that saw that by installing the 40-hour a week and the ridiculously high wage of, what, $5 a day, he'd end up influencing the country to have more customers for his cars. So maybe greed would keep the wages at a certain minimum level as long as the greedy people were smart enough.
Well, that's a collective action problem. Usually what happens is that every employer would prefer all the other employers to pay their workers well, while they themselves pay their workers poorly. In a case like that, where it's in everyone's interest to have higher wages collectively, but no one wants to do it individually, that provides a classic opportunity for government to intervene to the benefit of everyone.
I want to ask you about another point, because you're famous for lots of different things, Liz. But one of the things you're famous for is thinking is arguing that certain kinds of things are not appropriate to market. You know, like women's sexual labor, surrogate motherhood, stuff like that. You don't think there should be people's organs. You've argued in various places that, you know, those kinds of things, it's not right. It's somehow debasing, or it doesn't respect the kind of value they have, or something like that.
Liz, every day in the Stanford Daily, there's ads for eggs, $5,000 to $15,000 for the right egg. Is that a good thing, as Martha might say?
Well, actually, I'm less opposed to markets in gametes, that is, eggs and sperm, than to markets in women's reproductive labor, that is, where you're actually hiring a woman to bear a child. The reason for that is that when a woman's hired to bear a child for another, her autonomy is compromised in that relationship. Whereas if she just alienates an egg, she can walk away from it. Nobody's controlling what she does for the next 9 months. She just gives up a few cells of her body. There are other problematic aspects of selling sperm and egg. I do sometimes wonder why men who've sold their sperm multiple times don't worry about all their offspring, or think that perhaps they have some kind of responsibility for the well-being of many, many children that they have brought into the world.
Yeah. But lots of men who don't sell their sperm and just have one or two children manage to not worry about them. So
you said,
well, that's right.
I don't know what the point of that is, but it's a fact.
You said something a little puzzling to me. We may have to get back to it after the break, but let's just put this question to you. You said that if a woman sells her reproductive labor, it doesn't respect her autonomy or something like that. But people, defenders of the market, think that autonomy is the highest value of the market, because there's these free decisions that people make, these free, uncoerced transactions. So it's kind of strange to criticize the market on the basis of undermining autonomy in a certain way. Don't you think?
Well, I think we have to examine two different phases of the market transaction.
Liz, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought for until after the break, because we're coming up on a break. In a bit, we'll open up the phone lines. Here's our question for you, our audience. What ethical limit should we place on the markets? Should everything be bought and sold, or are there some things that it's simply wrong to buy and sell? Is it okay to provide people, say, by government fiat goods that the free market won't provide them, like housing or healthcare? You tell us what you think.
Go to our website, www.philosophytalk.org, and send us a comment, and we may read your email right here on the radio and figure out what to say to you.
Philosophy Talk continues after this short break.
Ella Fitzgerald with a bit of her version of the Cole Porter song, Love for Sale. Love for sale, that's prostitution. Prostitution is a market most states try to prohibit. Are these prohibitions a good idea? Is there something intrinsically wrong with a market in prostitution? Or is there something about prostitution and selling these kind of services to the highest bidder that's intrinsically demeaning and sucks the meaning out of an important part of human life? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Joining us today is Elizabeth Anderson from the University of Michigan. She's author of the fascinating book, Value and Ethics in Economics. We'd like you to join our conversation about the ethical limits of markets. You can give us a call at 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or you can go to our beautiful website. You got to see this thing, www.philosophytalk.org. Click on the comments link up on the upper right-hand corner there and send us a comment. We'll read your comment on the air if we like it.
But don't get too involved in our website because we want you to listen to this program.
Yeah,
here's the questions you might be thinking about. Should everything be bought and sold, or are there some things that it's simply wrong to buy and sell? Is it okay or not okay to provide people with basic goods that the free market won't provide them?
Liz, before the break, you were about to make a comment. I was challenging you on the surrogate motherhood, somehow debasing the autonomy. I mean, people think that the market is the thing that respects people's autonomy. So why don't you?
Right. I think we have to distinguish between the freedom we exercise in entering into a contract and the freedom we enjoy while satisfying the terms of a contract. It is true that markets are very good at preserving freedom in entering a contract. But if the content of the contract strips away someone's freedom and autonomy, I think it's time to question whether it should be recognized as legally valid. So, for instance, we don't accept contracts into slavery, even if people voluntarily enter into them.
Yeah.
Now, surrogate motherhood is not equivalent to slavery, but it does involve stripping the gestational mother of certain powers and rights of judgment that she would otherwise exercise. Suppose, after having signed a contract promising to turn over her child to the adoptive parents, she discovers that, in fact, they would not make very good parents and has some doubts about that. If we treat this as a contract that's enforceable, she would have to give up the child anyways. That is, her judgment, her autonomy of judgment over who would best raise the child is abrogated.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, though. I mean, I see your point in a way, but imagine a person who reflectively, considerately decides that they want to do this and they don't have second thoughts and you know, they enter into this bargain with another person. I mean, is there some reason why they shouldn't be able to do that? Or are you advocating a kind of paternalism that even, you know, even if you do reflectively, autonomously, freely enter into this bargain, somehow you shouldn't, and we know you shouldn't?
Well, there's a couple of things at stake here. Of course, it's also the fact that there's a child involved, not just the contracting parties. And I do find it problematic that the surrogate contract treats the child as an object up for sale, as if its interests don't carry any independent weight. So in my preferred system, these kinds of arrangements should be treated in a dispute as just like any other custody dispute between parents. And the contract should be regarded as completely irrelevant. In addition, I don't think such contracts should be enforceable.
So let's shift to another area you've written a little bit about, and that's prostitution that Ella Fitzgerald was singing about.
Mm-hmm.
I can understand arguments that charging for sexual favors takes something that, in some sense, was meant to be a gift or has its highest value when it's exchanged between people who are mutually sharing with no economic considerations. It turns it into a commodity. It demeans it. And a person who sells her sexual favors probably has a self-image that is not quite what we would want. But still, How about that person themselves? So do they say, well, you know, maybe I have a bad self-image, but don't I have a right to earn a living any way I want? Aren't you kind of legislating morality for people when you say that there shouldn't be a market in the thing they choose to sell?
I think we should separate two different issues here. One is whether markets in prostitution are morally objectionable. And the second issue is whether we should actually prohibit it. I do think they're morally objectionable, partly for the reasons that you've articulated and partly because prostitution involves a contract in which there's no reciprocation of sexual interest. It's really a contract in which usually the man, overwhelmingly, the man gets pandered to and doesn't really have to pay attention to the prostitute as an individual in her own right with her own perspectives. And the difficulty with such a system is not just what it does to the prostitute and the attitude that the customer expresses towards her, but also attitudes towards sexuality and towards other sexual partners who might not be prostitutes, that he might start inflicting the same attitudes on them. There are serious spillover effects here that affect third parties who are not part of the contract that I think make prostitution morally objectionable and give third parties an interest in regulating it.
So, having said that,
I think all things considered, if we look at the way laws against prostitution have been enforced, that there's a very sorry record in which prostitutes become cast as outlaws and are deprived of any effective legal protection and subject to all kinds of exploitation. And for that reason, I think on balance, I'm opposed to making prostitution illegal, but not opposed to making pimping
John
illegal.
Wants to make a quick point. Then we're going to take some callers.
No, let's go ahead with the callers. Okay. I think she hit the point I was going
to
raise.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can join our discussion at 415-841. I'm here with my colleague John Perry, and I'm Ken Taylor. We're talking with Liz Anderson. We have a caller in the line, Philippe in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philippe.
Yes, hi. Thank you. I'm a bit nervous over the radio, so please excuse me.
Okay.
The Age of Enlightenment gave us philosophers who gave us the notion of a social contract, and that was between the people and the sovereign. Then the Enlightenment gave us the American Revolution, where it was we the people which became the sovereign. And we the people collectively own a number of assets, not only land, buildings, and so on, but also the judicial code and other social organizational functions which allow people to get rich. And this is a real asset which we have a right to have a return on, so that society ought to allow a certain basic minimum level of comfort to all of us, because it is just the return on the assets.
So you're arguing against the Ayn Rand point of view that says that we're really just kind of doing something totally artificial and without right when we restrict the market in any way.
Absolutely, and the Rand people, I don't know how far they've gone into this, but A.C. Pigou, an economist in the 1920s, had the polluters pay principle, and you need enforcement of that through some government regulation. Otherwise, a polluter will just enforce externalities. A polluter might cause asthma and just get by with it, unless there were some regulation or some mechanism.
But where do you draw the line between righteous regulation and over-regulation? What do you think?
It's a very tough line to draw, but that is why we have legislatures.
Yeah, that's a good point, Philip.
There's kind of a market in legislators, though, I think we sometimes have to worry about, that's a different issue.
Thanks very much for the call, Philippe. You've raised lots of questions. Liz, do you have any response to Philippe's
point? I'm very much in sympathy with what Philippe was saying on both counts, both that given that everyone is contributing to the maintenance of a system of private property— through the enforcement of property laws and the taxes they pay to support a police force and a judiciary and so forth, it's only fair that everyone see some kind of return from that. And that, I think, does justify at least putting a floor on how poor people can get their society.
I think that's a good
point. Now, Elizabeth, as I understand your view, though, it's not so much a matter of drawing a line as it's just understanding the nature of a market transaction. It's a certain kind of relationship between buyer and seller, buyer and commodity. It's impersonal. It's just regulated by people's wants. And it's not just drawing a line. It's just that that's just a totally wrong model for certain kinds of transactions. Could you expand on that a little?
Yes. We exchange goods a lot of the time in order to express certain kinds of relationships that we have with one another. So we can, for instance, take a look at gift exchange, where the whole point of the gift exchange is not to receive an item of value, but really to cement a kind of personal relationship that's based on mutual recognition and affection. Sometimes norms of the market can start infecting gift exchange and distort those relationships. I was just reading the other day in the paper about someone who had a wedding and started demanding cash gifts from her bridesmaids. This seems to be a case of people not quite getting the point of marriage.
I see your point. I mean, I think you have a good point, but I would challenge it. I'll challenge it briefly, then I'll let a caller in here because we need to hear from some more callers. Okay.
Are we making these callers pay, Ken? Let's got a scarce commodity here.
Gift exchange. Some things, like if I'm in a certain relationship with people, I give them things. I don't sell them things. I would give my son my house. But I wouldn't give you my house, Liz, as much as I like you. I'd sell it to you, but I wouldn't give it. It's not the thing per se. I mean, so sexual favors. I give my wife sexual favors as a free gift. But, you know, other people I may not give. I mean, so just because I'm in certain relationships with certain people and so should enter in market relations with them doesn't mean for those very same things I can't enter in market relations with somebody else. But before I let you respond, I'm gonna. That's kind of a trick. I'm gonna let a caller in here. Enriquez, do I have that right? In San Francisco?
Yes.
What's your question?
Well, this wasn't exactly a question. It's just the Ayn Rand philosophy is based on social Darwinism, which, in my opinion, is fallacious. It's fallacious because it doesn't look at the whole of biology, for example, because...
Social Darwinism, why don't you give us a two-sentence explanation of what you mean by that?
Well, for what I understand of it is that every person is in competition with another person.
That'll do for right now, John, okay? So okay. Think that's a mistake or something?
Yeah, it's fallacious because... looking at biology, you can see things where biological organisms cooperate with other biological organisms. For example, trees that bear fruits. They bear fruits so animals will eat them, so they will spread their germ around. Now, you might say that's not altruistic, but it's sort of a stretched... call that not altruistic.
Yeah, thanks, Enrique. I mean, it's true that there are lots of people, evolutionary biologists, who think that altruism is an evolved thing. I mean, human beings are deeply altruistic in one way. Liz, do you have a comment on that, Liz?
Sure. I mean, we have both self-interest and altruism, but I'm also interested in another motivation that has evolved in human beings, and that's a sense of justice. Justice, I think, should be distinguished from altruism, and I think provides a better foundation for understanding some of the kinds of social welfare provisions that liberals tend to advocate. It's not just a matter of feeling good for about people and trying to be nice to them. I think they do emerge more from demands of justice than from altruism.
Okay, we have another caller in the line. That's Edwin in New York City. Hey, we got a call all the way from New York City. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Edwin.
Thank you. Hello.
You're listening to us online, I take it.
I am, yes.
Okay, so what's your comment?
The discussion has gone from capitalism to personal items. In other words, it's sort of a fringe discussion of lifeboat situations, if you will, concerning free markets, but not a fundamental discussion that your first speaker was talking about, Mr. Binswanger.
Yeah. So you want to get us back to that?
Capitalism is centered on the idea that individuals have rights, and our country is based on the protection of those rights. The line from the Declaration is that to assure these rights, governments are instituted among men. So if you just imagine looking out a window at the whole... country from coast to coast, just figuratively speaking, what you see is commerce and industry taking place. contractual arrangements, contracts that mean something, that can't be abrogated by statements like Ms. Anderson is making. And this has to do with individual rights and the right to earn a living. Getting rich, as we speak about poor people, is figurative. It means richer. In other words, one can get an education, go out and earn, and so forth. There's charity for those who don't quite make it, who try, but there would be no charity if there wasn't wealth in the first place, would there?
Well, I think you make a very good point. One might be skeptical about a completely laissez-faire philosophy, but still have a vivid appreciation for all the good things that markets do. There seems to be kind of two points, not to the necessarily Ayn Rand point of view, but the defense of markets. One is that there's just certain basic rights involved. If I've got something and I wanted to sell it to you, who should stop me? Now, if it's a child, somebody should, maybe. But for a wide range of things, nobody should. I mean, it's mine. I can sell it. Why shouldn't I?
Yeah.
Then the other point is that experience suggests that at least for a wide range of activities, markets do pretty well. There are these people that think they're perfect, and they're not. But for a wide range of things, they do pretty well. So let's not just focus on the reasonable limitations of markets.
Yeah, I want to make my lefty point here. I mean, there's a quote I love from the Communist Manifesto. I'm not a communist now. Don't get on my case. But Marx said something beautiful, I think, about capitalism. Here's an example of the kind of thing he said. It has pitilessly torn asunder the motley feudal ties that bound man to his, quote, natural superiors, and has left remaining no other nexus between man and man than naked self-interest, than callous cash payment. He goes on and on. He says it reduces personal worth to mere exchange value. Now, I think there's something wrong with that. I think Marx was onto something. And I wonder what you think, Liz, briefly about that.
Well, I'm actually a fan of capitalism, properly regulated and properly understood. The caller was correct to state that even in order to have the social welfare benefits that we get from the state, you have to have a foundation of wealth to start with. And in modern experience, we know that you can't get that through centralized government control and planning. You do need a very capacious space for free markets to operate to generate that wealth.
I agree with you about that.
Like TAs. I think we at universities all feel that there should be a pretty free market with respect to TAs. That's a joke.
Yeah.
We're going to have to... You know, over here at the University of Michigan, we have a graduate students labor union.
Yeah, right. We're going to have to take a few minutes to consider these deep issues. We'll be right back with the 60-second philosopher, Ian Scholes. Ian will present us with a snapshot of the life and writings of our friend Karl Marx. There's more philosophy talk after this short break.
The band 10cc doing the Wall Street Shuffle. All of you Wall Streeters out there waiting for the market to close in 15 minutes know that that's been going on since they started the New York Stock Exchange in 1817. I'm John Perry. I don't do very well on the stock market, but this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We'll be getting back to our guest Liz Anderson in a little bit and taking more of your calls at 415-841-4134 or your questions from our website at www.philosophytalk.org. But before we do that, we have a regular feature on our program, the 60-Second Philosopher, Ian Scholes.
Each week, Ian Scholes examines a philosopher or philosophical movement and distills the essence of it into about 60 seconds.
Today, Ian's subject is Karl Marx. He was no fan of free markets. He was kind of the polar opposite of Ayn Rand that we heard about up in the top of the show in Amy's Pete's. Isn't that right, John?
Absolutely. We may say that the workers may control the means of production, but only Ian Scholes controls the speed of his diction. Prepare yourself. Ready? Go.
Ian Scholes. Karl Marx was born of Jewish parents in Prussia in 1818, but in 1824, Karl's father changed his name from Herschel to Heinrich, and the whole family converted to Lutheranism. Soon thereafter, Heinrich's legal career began to prosper. Karl Marx's high school thesis, Religion, the Glue That Binds Society Together, won a prize. He eventually earned a Ph.D. in philosophy and then became editor of the radical newspaper Rheinische Zeitung, where his demands for radical reforms led to its suppression in 1843. He went to Paris, where he began his lifelong association with both socialism and with Friedrich Engels, his Boswell, his Watson. In 1847, he joined the Communist League and wrote the Communist Manifesto with Engels. Unwelcome in Europe, Karl Marx settled in London in 1849. There, he was chronically ill and in bitter poverty. Three of his children died. He earned some money as a journalist, but was mainly dependent on Engels and his own family for financial aid. An angry bohemian, he smoked and drank heavily, ate poorly, seldom bathed. He also never set foot in a factory, mine, or mill, even though Engels ran a textile mill. He also had a live-in maid who was never paid a dime and with whom he had a illegitimate child. And he was terrible with money. Marx didn't philosophize so much as predict. In the Communist Manifesto, for instance, he says, quote, "Along with the constantly diminishing number of the magnates of capital grows the mass of misery, oppression, slavery, degradation, exploitation. But with this, too, grows the revolt of the working class, a class always increasing in numbers, and disciplined, united, organized by the very mechanism of capitalist production itself. The monopoly of capital becomes a fetter upon the mode of production. Centralization of the means of production and socialization of labor at last reach a point where they become incompatible with their capitalist integument. Thus, integument is burst asunder. The knell of capitalist private property sounds. The expropriators are expropriated," end quote. Well, the integument is still intact, near as I can tell, unless the busted dot-com bubble counts. Karl Marx believed that capitalism was incorrigible and doomed. Capitalism may, in fact, be incorrigible. Check out Enron, Martha Stewart, and Halliburton, but I wouldn't put capitalism's doomsday on the calendar anytime soon. Karl Marx's legacy? Dictators in Russia, Eastern Europe, Cuba, China and Africa, gulags, coups, purges, corruption, and bankrupt economies. And on the capitalist side, a shrinking working class, or outsourced working class anyway, and a growing bourgeoisie in the form of entrepreneurs, CEOs, lottery winners, and divorcees in Nevada looking to get their real estate licenses. Marx got one thing right, though, commodity fetishism. He claimed that in capitalism, people come to believe that the things they produce are the sources of power and creativity, not the people themselves. They begin to mediate relationships through commodities, like cell phones, DVDs, video games, SUVs, and fancy shoes, for instance. Karl Marx died in 1883. He's buried in Highgate Cemetery, London. I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher detailing the life of Karl Marx. Kant, Hegel, Marx on the one side, Hume, Adam Smith, Ayn Rand on the other side. Philosophers have certainly had a lot of influence on the world, Ken. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our guest is Liz Anderson from the University of Michigan. Liz, I know you said you endorsed capitalism, and you know I'm not a Marxist myself, but there is something about I'm going to come back to this point of Marx's, that one of the things that capitalism has done is reduce all relations between, as he put it, man and man to raw calculations of naked self-interest. And he thought that was a bad thing. Actually, he thought that was kind of a progressive thing, but not complete progress. Your view seems to have at least this similarity with Marx's view, that there's more between man and man than raw calculations of naked self-interest, and that we kind of fail to see the sources of value when we think the market should determine everything. Have I got that right or wrong?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right, although I wouldn't accept Marx's view that capitalism relentlessly grinds out all other kinds of relationships in its wake.
Yeah.
I think there are certainly perhaps tendencies in that direction, but we have a lot of other robust institutions that that resist. You know, we have spheres of personal relationships. We have churches. We have democracy. There's all kinds of other institutions that are compatible with capitalism and soften some of its harsher edges.
I agree with you entirely. John, you have an email question there, I think.
Yes,
right?
I've got an email question. It's very interesting. This is from Dan in San Francisco, and he says, what do you think of market-based policies to reduce pollution? A free market supposes a reduction in pollution if companies that pollute are not patronized by disapproving customers. This assumes consumers have access to information about a computer's environmental policies. What do you think? I think that's a good question. I mean, on the free market side, you could say, look, if people had to absorb the costs of the pollution that they wreck on the environment into the price of their products, then the market would encourage people that don't pollute. But the problem is, can the market make that the case, or do you require a kind of a strong government to put those penalties in?
You want to comment on that, Liz?
Yeah, there's two different mechanisms we could imagine here. One would be a system of green labeling where, say, some independent non-governmental organization could stamp various products as being environmentally sound or produced with very little pollution. We have that, for instance, with dolphin-safe tuna, where we have these labels. I'm not sure how reliable they are. And that depends on consumers demanding products that were produced through clean processes. An alternative, which I favor, it's not incompatible with the first one, but I think it's necessary, is that we impose some kind of taxation on pollution so that people who buy, say, a gas-guzzling SUV would have to pay for the pollution they spew out.
Right, right. There's another. I have a question. A caller here has a question about sort of the commons, the same sort of question. Catherine in Oakland wants to ask us about privatizing water. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Catherine.
Well, hi. One of you said a few minutes ago, well, if it's mine, I can sell it, and no one should be able to interfere. And so I say, but how do you get it? And there, in that way, I'm referring to privatizing water or, for instance, keeping green hydrogen off the charts in favor of selling the hydrogen you've produced through nuclear or coal power. And I'll refer you to John Prine when he said, oh, Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County down by the Green River where paradise lay? Well, I'm sorry, my son, but you're too late in asking. Mr. Peabody's coal train done hauled it all away.
Okay, man, that was great.
Hey,
thank
you. Why don't we have that song on here?
Interlude there. So, Liz, you got a comment about that at all?
Well, it is true that if you go back in the history of the original acquisition of property, it's very hard to find any immaculate conception in original acquisition. There's been a lot of theft. We can see that, for instance, most notably in the recent capitalization of the Russian economy, which has basically now been taken over by a den of thieves. I think the conclusion to draw from this is not that we can actually figure out what the original just allocation would have been back then and try to restore that. It's kind of a hopeless project.
Yeah.
But rather to try to ensure that at least as things stand now, everyone has a decent chance at a reasonable standard of living.
Now, Liz, you make a distinction that, you know, the commodities that are on the market are typically ones that if one person's using them, somebody else can't. I think we've seen with water and air things kind of drifting into that direction and things that we used to think were limitless.
Unfortunately, Liz, I'm not going to give you much of a chance to respond to that, but briefly, if you have a brief response to that.
Well, it is true that there are some goods that we share all together, and consequently, if we want to maintain their quality, the only realistic way to do that is to have laws that prevent individuals from polluting or at least tax them and discourage their pollution. And similarly for anything else that we share in common, like the Earth.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Liz. It's been a pleasure having you on Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.
John, you got a brief, are you wise? I always ask you if you're wise at this point. Tell me briefly if you're wise now.
Oh, I guess my mind hasn't been changed too much, but I've gotten from talking to Liz and reading some of her materials, I think, a better understanding of my kind of wishy-washy liberal markets are okay in their place philosophy I started out with.
Yeah, me too. I mean, I believe in the mixed economy. It seems to me that's a wishy-washy thing, but the mixed economy seems the right answer. We haven't gotten to the bottom of this. If you want to continue this discussion, you can click on our webpage at www.philosophytalk.org and click on the forums link and sign up for one of our forums. We'd love to hear more from you.
And we won't charge you for whatever you want to do on our website.
Yeah.
Zip right up. Everyone's a winner, bargains galore. That's right, you two can be the proud owner. The quality goes in before that name goes on. One-tenth of a dollar, one-tenth of a dollar. We got service after the sale. How about perfume? We got perfume. How about an engagement ring? Some for the little lady, some for the little lady, some for the little lady. $3-$4. We got a year-end clearance. We got our white sale and a smoke-damaged furniture. You can drive it away today.
What's that drumming?
That's not drumming, Ken. That's conundrumming.
Oh.
A conundrum is when some listener has a question or a problem or a paradox or a puzzle in their life that has a certain philosophical aspect to it, which will allow us to talk about it without really doing much good.
We have a caller on the line now.
Hello.
Welcome, Chris. This is Chris from Oregon, right?
Yes.
What place in Oregon?
Portland.
Portland. What a wonderful place.
What do you do up there in Portland, Chris?
I do research at a medical school.
What's your question, Chris?
Well, the conundrum that I have is how do people, and especially leaders who have a moral imperative, live with the level of hypocrisy that they demonstrate to us almost daily?
Pretty well, as far as I can
yeah,
see.
Yeah, without blinking an eye.
Yeah. I guess not that they can deal with it, but how do they? What kinds of compensation must they make in their own mind, in their own lives?
What strikes me, Ken, is that utilitarians might be a little better off as politicians than Kantians. You want to explain why I have that deep thought?
Yeah, you put these big distinctions on my back, John. This is, you're making me work hard here. I guess a utilitarian says the best course of events is the one that gives the greatest happiness for the greatest number, something like that.
So if you have to lie, you can justify that by its consequences. Or if you have to go on television and you say, I agree with President Bush that we shouldn't allow gays to marry, when actually you think it's perfectly all right for gays to marry. But you can say to yourself, if I say that, it won't make much difference as to whether gays marry, but it will help get the new hydroelectric dam for Montana and make lives better or something like that. Then if you're a utilitarian, that's okay.
Yeah, and if you're a Kantian, though, you have to think about matters of morality differently, because Kant says the only thing that's good without qualification is a good will. And what he means by that is good consequences can't make a bad act of will good, right? So if you, lie, you're having ill will toward another person because you're deceiving them, leading them astray in all sorts of ways. And even if the consequences of that are beneficial, it's not a good thing. Are you with us so far, Chris?
Yes, I am. And I'm wondering, do you think that the level of hypocrisy that we see in our leaders has grown over the last few decades? Or do we just have access to more information so we catch them in it more often?
I think probably the latter and the former. I think it's grown and we catch them more often. But I want to say something in defense of the politicians. Why, if they're hypocrites, are they hypocrites? Just because they like being hypocritical? Well, no, but because sometimes they can't speak the truth. Why can't they speak the truth? Well, because they won't get elected or reelected. So part of the reason politicians are hypocrites is because we, in some ways, demand that they be.
But I think we're in a dangerous place in our country if everyone sees the need to be reelected above the need to govern well.
There's a paradox there, the paradox of democracy, that the ones who care most about governing and least about being reelected in the long run are going to be the ones that don't get reelected.
Yeah, right. But I think, so the point is, we have to change ourselves. We have to change what we demand. We have to have a sterner stomach for truth and hard choices. It's on us. Because we have democratic structures, not perfect by any means, but because we have these democratic structures, if we seize the power and demand certain things, we can make hypocrisy go away. Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks a lot, Chris.
Yeah,
I enjoyed talking to you.
Bye-bye.
If there's a conundrum in your life, don't keep it to yourself. Let's see if there's a philosophical issue at the core. We probably won't help you with your problem, but we'll have some fun discussing it. How can folks contact us, Ken?
They can just head to our website, www.philosophytalk.org. They can click on the button at the top right called Conundrums. That's www.philosophytalk.org. The harder the conundrum, the better. I'd like to see John squirm.
The harder the conundrum, the better. Speak for yourself. Send the easy ones to me. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2004. Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institute, the Greenwald Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from the Provost's Office at Stanford University, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Stanford's Office of Public Affairs, the Stanford Humanities Center, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio 91.7 San Francisco, where our program originates.
Don't forget the Friends of Philosophy Talk. The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University, our funders, or John, or Ken, or anybody else.
Our discussion continues online at the forum at www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Next week, we'll dedicate our program to the ethical notions put forth by Nietzsche. Thank you very much for listening.
And thank you for thinking.